You're listening to the Biohackers World Podcast.
All right, welcome to Biohackers World. I am Samantha Lander, a functional diagnostic nutritionist, a speaker, an influencer, a mom, and a DJ. I'm really excited to have Brendan here today. We're going to talk to him a little bit about what he does. Brendan is a mental and metabolic health researcher, a functional medicine practitioner, educator, writer, speaker. He is board certified holistic health practitioner, master nutrition coach, master personal trainer, USAW sports performance coach, and CrossFit trainer, and actually a whole lot more. I'm really excited to have you on today because you're a fellow FDN practitioner, so we know each other from that that world. But I wanted to hear a little bit about the Navy SEAL story first.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, Samantha. It's really cool sitting here, an amazing setup, and this beautiful hotel in Chicago during the summer. It couldn't be better. So, you know, I appreciate the introduction, listening to all those credentials is kind of reflective of this eclectic journey that I've been on that, you know, started when I was a senior in high school. At that point in time, literally my life goal was to become a Navy SEAL. I grew up doing martial arts and really got into the way of the samurai and Bushido and all of these kind of Japanese philosophies. And so I was like, well, what's the American modern day equivalent of the samurai? Navy SEAL is what I landed on, right? So I actually signed a 6-year Navy SEAL contract when I was 18 and worked really, really hard for that goal. But I was about almost halfway through boot camp, so Spec Ops pipeline. It's not like I was in, you know, Hell Week in Coronado or doing anything that cool. But even during boot camp, they do a lot of medical evaluation. And so they discovered I had a pre-existing injury that required surgery. And ultimately, it kind of felt like my life goal was taken away from me with that medical discharge. So I was kind of lost for a while. I was working at the gym. All I did was work out and train for this really hard military training. And so during that time, I got really depressed. And I was working with the recruiters to try to get back into the military and Spec Ops. But people don't realize, like, it's actually not that easy to get into the military, let alone Spec Ops. And so when you've had a medical discharge, you can't just turn around and hop right back in. And so I had this lag time and I needed a new purpose. And so it was a pretty organic pivot into, well, you know, I'll become a personal trainer, nutrition coach, kind of try that out, see how it feels. Mm-hmm. And honestly, once I started going through those certification programs and that education, I fell in love with the science, I fell in love with the service, and here I am like 15 years later.
I love that you had a phrase I heard on a podcast that functional medicine, right, it chose you, you didn't choose it. And I was like, that's brilliant. Like, I feel like that's exactly what a lot of us, that's our story, and that's kind of where it comes from. But it's really hard. It kind of reminds me of like after the Olympics, how they have that PT, that depression phase where like they lose everything they've been building their entire life for, and then they get that lull. It's almost like postpartum depression, but with a job. All right, so I know you're an EDM fan, so I had to ask that. And I'm a DJ, so like I came out of retirement at 40. Four, and I'm like DJing massive raves and stuff. It's crazy. So I read a lot about the link between EDM music and mental health and how it works with the brain and like how it helps heal. There's all these studies that they're doing, whether or not they're legit, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I kind of wanted to know like what your thoughts were on that. On like, it's the rhythm of the music. It's like everything about how EDM music can actually help heal your brain and help with anxiety and depression. Or like they say, you know, people who go to raves are, you know, 80% happier because they go dance and they do these things. So I just wanted to know your thoughts on it.
You know, I can't say that's ever something I've really looked into, but I would be curious, you know, from like brainwave activity and how it's being altered by the frequency of the music. Because I know for me, I mean, I love the music. It gets me moving, unlike anything else, the different rhythms and frequencies, and it's all very layered together. So I'm sure it's altering our neuroplasticity, neurogenesis, and brainwave activity. I don't know all the mechanisms of it, but it would be cool to plot that out.
My curveball question for you.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you could capture biomarkers and brainwaves kind of pre and post and see. And then, of course, a lot of the ravers are, you know, on MDMA and psilocybin and who knows what else. So
I know. I think it's interesting. I always think it's interesting, too, like, if those kind of sounds and like those hertz, like there's a DJ Lincoln Jesser where he actually creates music to certain hertz, and actually I wonder if it would like heal. He talks about it healing the gut and doing things like that. I'm like, would it kill mold? Would it do that?
Yeah,
because I know you're like, you were the mold guy. Now you're not.
Yeah, well, still, I mean, we're releasing a new mold course this month, so we're still going with the mold.
Well, tell me a little bit of how you got into the mold the mold topic. You're always my go-to. If I have a tough client, I'm always like, here, just call him.
Well, I appreciate that. That explains some of the interesting inquiries that we get in our email box that then we're trying to unpack. But the mold thing was interesting because I was at this point in my life, I was in a really unhealthy, toxic relationship, to say the least. And that's a long, dark story that ended in her taking her life years later. And she got mysteriously ill. We were engaged at the time and nobody could figure out what was wrong with her. So we went to conventional, naturopathic, chiropractic, physiotherapy. We were kind of doing our own amateur research, and being a very science forward health and fitness professional, I kind of took it upon myself of like, well, I got to save her, right? I was trying to save her. I was trying to save us. And I was unsuccessful. Ultimately, I got burned by that situation pretty bad, but it was really trying to save her and improve my own mental health that kind of steered me deeper into functional medicine, like you were alluding to. I feel like the functional life chose me through that path, right? And so I really dove into subjects like MTHFR and methylation that I'm presenting about today. Or it wasn't until years after that relationship that I was introduced to the concept of mold illness. And when I was, a lot of things clicked. Now, to be clear, I don't know if she had mold illness. I never confirmed it. But I do know we lived in a water-damaged home. It was older. It clearly had water damage, probably some elevated mold growth. And from a clinical presentation perspective, not that mold illness is clearly defined from a diagnostic criteria. You know, there's not an ICD-11 diagnostic code for mold illness, right? But the concept and how it presents clinically, like, she kind of fit all those symptom clusters to a T. So
you probably know too. I feel like organically we know in our gut when someone.
So I kind of had this like vendetta against mold for a while. And, you know, it's kind of like growing up with wrestling and martial arts. They say, you know, once you've wrestled, everything else in life is easy. I kind of feel that way clinically about mold and Lyme. Like, if you can learn how to help people navigate complex chronic illness, everything else clinically seems relatively easy in comparison. So that was what got me on the mold path.
Yeah, I get it. I was engaged to a guy with, like, severe eczema and psoriasis, and it was, like, became my mission to, like, help him heal. And you can't help someone who doesn't want to be helped, or sometimes they don't even, you know,
there's a lot of layers to that.
So tell me a little bit about the MTFHR work that you do. I think it's really important, but I also think it's a word that's just thrown around now and people don't really understand it. Like, I have a lot of women with, you know, having chronic miscarriage after miscarriage, and they come to me and I was like, well, were you tested for that? And then it's a battle for them to just become an advocate for themselves with a doctor. So maybe you could just touch on anything with that.
Oh, man.
MTFHR is very complicated.
It's a big subject. So I have a course that teaches methylation. It's about 17 hours long because it's just, you know, it's step by step by step biochemistry and the testing. I think it's a very complicated, misunderstood subject. And what's kind of neat about my story is it kind of elucidates, I think, the mass populace's interest in MTHFR. Because for me, it was when I was with that fiance, and the very first thing we did when she got sick was go to the conventional doctor. And they ran, you know, pretty standard blood work, but they had added on the MTHFR SNP, the 677-1298 alleles. Exactly. So this was 2014. This was my first exposure to it. Yeah, they were really ahead of their time, you know, hindsight, 2020. And so, you know, I didn't know what this MTHFR thing was. And the doctor's like, well, it, you know, alters neurotransmitters. And so we'll put you on a compounded thing. So they prescribed this compounded nutraceutical that was, I quote, 15 milligrams of methylfolate, 15 milligrams of methylcobalamin, some NAC and vitamin D3. And what I can candidly say is 15 milligrams is a megadose. And it was based on the SNP, the genetic polymorphism, not the current state of physiology, not the current state of methylation. So I dove into Ben Lynch's work. At the time, he was the guy for MTHFR, and he still is. I want to give credit where credit's due, because I think Gary Brecka has reached more people with MTHFR, but Ben Lynch was kind of the pioneer and OG, and Abraham Hoffer before him. So it's a deep subject that is now really popular, and I can't help but wonder, it's like, well, how many other biochemical pathways are just as important, but we don't really know much about? But with MTHFR, everybody's kind of captivated by these two polymorphisms, when in reality, there's 12 other variants just for the MTHFR gene that are shown to be clinically relevant. And we're not talking about them, we're not testing them. So I think people kind of get exposed to the subject. I think not that anybody's trying to mislead them, but then it becomes like, well, do I have the SNP, and then how do I treat it with supplements and megadosing, methylfolate, methylcobalamin? It's quite a bit more nuanced than that.
I think it becomes a focus. Well, that's the solution. Like, I'm just going to take this methylfolate, and then it's going to solve all my problems.
Right.
And like, it's just, as we know, it's like whole body wellness. So there's a lot more.
Yeah.
All right. On that note, this is a hard question. I don't know why they even asked me to ask this, but one lab marker you wish that everybody checked.
Yeah, well, I mean, since we're kind of piggybacking the MTHFR thing, I mean, homocysteine is really the gold standard. We can also look at the SAM-SAW ratio, which would hypothetically be better, but it's less clinically validated than homocysteine. And, you know, conventionally, classically, homocysteine is a marker, like a prognostic marker of cardiovascular disease, but we can use it as a functional indicator of methylation. I would say it's probably top 10, top 5, maybe most valuable biomarkers for not just cardiometabolic, but also neuropsychiatry, neurodegenerative, neurodevelopmental, so anything neuro or cognitive. Yeah. But homocysteine's not even my favorite. I mean, there's a lot of other biomarkers like neurofilament light chain or S100B protein that are more cutting edge and more neurospecific. But homocysteine, it's cheap, accessible. Everybody should be measuring it at least once or twice a year to keep it in that tight range.
Okay. So I'm kind of curious. So what is your like typical client that you tend to see now that you've become like kind of like the brain and the like mental health expert and then the mold expert? And like, as I think for me, I've like transformed, and now I'm working with like people who are now sober and like trying to heal their body. And that's become my area. Like you, and so those are kind of the clients I get. Like, who would be like the typical person you come and see, or that comes to see you?
Yeah, I mean, we get a little bit of everything. Yeah. What we tend to get the most of, what comes to mind, is we get a lot of middle-aged mothers that are trying to help their teenage kids or younger kiddos, whether it's, you know, mothers with children that have autism and they're trying to increase functionality, quality of life, or teenagers struggling with bipolar or OCD, anxiety, depression. So it's a lot of moms trying to help their kids that we do consulting with. And then we also get quite a bit of individuals that they've worked with a lot of other functional providers and kind of been labeled with all these scary, you have POTS and MCAS and dysautonomia and chronic fatigue and leaky this, leaky that, parasites.
Right.
And then they're all freaked out and stressed and have a lot of health anxiety and kind of a self-induced nocebo effect. And then they come to me thinking, well, I want to do the mental map. I think I have neuroinflammation. And most of the time they don't actually. So then it kind of checks that box of like, well, what else might be going on here?
Yeah.
And sometimes there's a lot of, like I said, the nocebo effect of they've been labeled with so many scary things that they're kind of stressing themselves into symptomatology. So there's a lot of layers that we have to unpack and bring it back to the objective data of, well, what does your lab testing show? And is the narrative that the lab testing would reveal in alignment with the psychological narrative that you're telling yourself? And we have to remedy that.
Yeah, it's important to listen to the client. They tell you. If you listen, they usually tell you what's going on.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's not at all what I thought you would say at all. So tell me, if you worked with kids who have ODD?
I mean,
with oppositional defiant disorder?
To a degree, yeah. And I think the hardest part about the work that I do, you know, I'm not a licensed psychologist and I'm not a psychiatrist. And a lot of times people that are coming to me are people that have already worked with some psychiatrists and psychologists, and they're kind of the mindset like, well, I don't really like medication, or maybe didn't work with me, resonate with me. I'm not really liking psychotherapy. So then they kind of get tuned into this, well, maybe it's some mysterious root cause, right? Mm-hmm. Where in reality, usually there's a lot of foundational components that have to be addressed, and we have to really reconcile and delineate between the dysfunctional physiology versus psychology or behavior, right? And then you start, I mean, sometimes with like oppositional defiance disorder of like, okay, this is a behavioral issue and it might, you know, need some child psychologist to work with the parents, and, you know, could there be a codependency between the parents and the children? So, you know, family dynamics,
my child has been diagnosed with that. That's why I asked. And so, but they were kind of like, it's a disease, but there's no medical, like there's nothing we can do for it.
Right.
And so the best thing to do is like a parent interactive, like play therapy. And that's what I chose to do. And then, but they're oppositional, so like some of it's like, I can't get him to eat. Like he's like, you would never have thought he was my child because he won't eat anything. Really? And he doesn't even care about eating. So like there's just stuff like that I've had to get through hurdles where I'm just like, okay, yeah. I'm either going to have a starving kid or I'm going to let him eat like XYZ, which isn't probably the best, but we're just got to a point where he's eating other things and I've been able to like work on the gut and do these things and it's a different child.
Yeah, yeah, so, well, that's a big part of it. If there is like, let's say gut brain axis dysfunction or inflammation or methylation issues, how is that then altering their neurochemistry and neurobiology that's altering their behavior? And that's where I try to separate like, okay, the behavioral, the psychology and the dynamics from the physiology. And it's like, well, there might be a lot of work to do over here, but if we at least try to support the physiology more intelligently, it might calm some of the
symptoms. That's what I think is starting to happen. But it's something that I've never experienced. Like it's a real thing. Like he's genetically wired. I mean, the way that he's so oppositional, he looks at himself and gets confused because it's so like crazy. Some of the stuff he would say when he was younger. So tell me a little bit about your mental map, your test.
Yeah, I mean, it's a ongoing project. It'll be the rest of my career at this point. But essentially, I was really trying to, this was when I was doing a lot of work in the mold space. And honestly, at that point in my career, it was like my whole life and career was centering around the mold thing. And I saw so many incongruencies and kind of dysfunction and chaos and confusion in that space. The practitioners seemed confused, the clients and patients seemed confused. Which way is up, right? And so I was on a mission of identifying, well, what biomarkers are the most clinically established in the research as having the most relevance and meaning for complex chronic disease? How do we bring it back to objective truth with these biomarkers to illuminate the path towards progress and healing? I always preach, we have to make sure we're tracking physiology more than chasing root causes, because I think people kind of get lost in the pursuit and the exploration of these root cause factors. But what we really care about is optimizing the physiology and biochemistry.
Yeah.
So eventually I was doing some research and development for a laboratory, and essentially I was trying to create a custom proprietary panel that was using the most relevant, validated, significant biomarkers. And really what I found, this is kind of sad, we have these amazing new biomarkers that are widely accessible through LabCorp and Quest, the medical giants, but nobody's using them. It's not standard of treatment in the conventional system, and the conventional system is really encouraged to minimize unnecessary lab testing to keep costs low. Even a lot of neurologists don't know about some of these new neurology, neuro-related biomarkers. And then a lot of the functional space, which is kind of the Wild West and entrepreneurial and kind of unregulated, a lot of functional practitioners don't know about these biomarkers. And so I'm really trying to teach practitioners to utilize some of these core biomarkers to really objectively elucidate what's going on physiologically or neurologically, as well as giving consumers more direct access and helping them understand how to make sense of that information, what to do with that, so then they can, try whatever biohacks or interventions, track the physiology and see, are we moving things in the right direction? That's a very simple explanation of it.
Yeah, so you're not just chasing. I feel like people are chasing like symptoms, chasing whatever they hear on Instagram or whatever it is. It's kind of scary. For sure. Is it a blood test? Is it urine or?
Yeah, there's been different renditions. I'm always evolving the panel. So definitely, core markers that have kind of been there from the beginning. We always encourage people to start with basic to more comprehensive just blood work, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cool urine tests and stool tests or genetic tests. These are all great and cool functional tests. But we really want to make sure we're using clinically established blood biomarkers above all else. They have way more clinical validity than a lot of these direct-to-consumer commercial tests. And so really looking at key biomarkers related to inflammation or immune activation or neuroinflammation or even neural injury, neuronal injury and damage, so that way we can really map what's going on internally. But currently it's all blood work. Previously there were some stool markers I think are still great, but honestly it's great to do a at-home stool test that we can measure microbiota composition and gastrointestinal physiology and so much more.
So it's interesting though that do you work, if you're a Navy SEAL or in the military or in the Army, you see a lot of brain trauma and head trauma. Do you, and a lot of PTSD. I'm surprised. Do you get a lot of clients from that?
You know, we get inquiries, but I don't get a lot of clients from that demographic. But that is a demographic I want to focus on through my research foundation in time. So, you know, I'm working my butt off to raise the funds to do the research I want to do through my foundation. And veterans with PTSD is a big area that I hope to serve and do research.
Yeah, it's almost like it can all come full circle.
Yeah, exactly.
They booted you, but now you're going to go help them. So
exactly.
there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on here. I appreciate it. You are a wealth of information. We could probably talk all day, but that's it.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Samantha.
You're welcome.
Come join us at Biohacker Miami, November 1st and 2nd.